This is Talk is Cheap on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Okay, continuing on, this is part three of a lecture on family abolition from the Tsunami books from back in July. And it's with M.E. O'Brien and Iman Abdelhadi, part three of that. First, though, I've got a little piece from the Rafa rally from May 15th, protesting our intervention, the sweep of Rafah, the genocide of Rafah. So that's coming up. Also, David Rovics was banned from playing at the university during this whole encampment debacle. So I'm working on a story on that. He was interviewed by David Zipan of Eugene Peace Works. And I just want to say one, I just want to clarify one thing. You know, it takes educated people to run whatever society, whatever style of society you're trying to run. It takes educated people to do that. So that's partly what I'm trying to do on this show, is educate people and open up the dialogue. I don't see where corporatism and fascism, those isms don't seem to work no matter how educated people educated you are. So that's where I'm coming from on that. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends, support independent media. And as I say, coming up, part three of Family Abolition with Emmy O'Brien and Iman Abdelhadi. And I'm just going to leave the demonstrators nameless at the Rafah demonstration.
Is dynamic, and we must support all forms of resistance by any means necessary. The world has abandoned Palestine, so I will never judge the means by which Palestinians fight back against the vicious Zionist regime. There are, of course, other battles. The battle of people's hearts. In this, Palestinians have won, and we see that in the university encampments all over the U.S. and the world. In showing the true face of Zionism and white supremacy, Palestine has won. The price they've paid and are still paying is unjustifiable, but that's where we are. And I hope with all my heart that Palestine will be free of Zionism, free for Jews, Christians, Muslims, and whoever, free of ethno-nationalism and white supremacy. The struggle for liberation and freedom has been going on for 76 plus years, and Palestinians have never given up, and neither shall we.
Themselves, so it can seem a little off balance sometimes, but
I think we all need to stick with them and stay in solidarity. And I hope to see all of you again repeatedly over the summer, too. So, I just want to say some stuff about, I don't know, I spent a lot of time in refugee camps, especially in the West Bank. Janine, Balata, Oscar, New Oscar, Mara. They're crazy, weird places that never had any planning. They started as tents, and then people started building houses. And they continued to build one on top of the other until they became these labyrinths. And there's just the most beautiful people there. And it's just, it's this favela spirit. And it's all mobilized for resistance. So, in the spirit of Nakba, I just want to talk about one of my friends who's a refugee. Nasser was an amazing Palestinian activist from Oscar refugee camp, right outside Nablus in the West Bank. Like many Palestinians, he was highly educated, intellectual, and also had a loving family life. At the time, he had a 2-year-old son who was hearing impaired, but he managed to get a sophisticated hearing aid from a relief organization. Unfortunately, he couldn't consistently afford batteries for the hearing aid. On the rare occasion his son's hearing aid was in working order, the small child would make a terrible racket, banging on things, yelling, singing, using the shaking and squeaking and oinking power of all those annoying baby toys and noisemakers to their maximum output. It was a lot. But you knew that this was one of the few times the child could actually hear. And over a long day, the racket would slowly fade away into silence again. Oscar was one of the densest refugee camps, but it was next to one of the biggest refugee camps in the West Bank, Balata. And the two had a legendary soccer rivalry. And the whole of the Nablus region would eagerly anticipate their annual match. One year the game was tied. Came all the way down to penalty kicks. On the last kick, there was a sudden field invasion. And fans of both refugee camps rushed the field and engaged in a vicious melee. Nasser was one of the cooler heads that prevailed. But a comedic scene unfolded where a local sheikh was on the field beating fans of both camps with a thin stick as the fighting unfolded around him. None dare lay a finger on the white-clad sheikh as he dealt out thrashings. But in the corner, two soccer players from the opposing teams looked at the chaos, shaking their heads about the lack of professionalism going on. The whole thing somehow ended in street protests that by the end had somehow evolved into speeches against the occupation and supporting remarks for the resistance. It was a strange metamorphosis and ultimately an expression of deep frustration. Very rarely a Palestinian refugee would ask a special favor from an international activist. It was an act of trust and friendship. Nasser asked us to bring him soil from his home in Haifa. There was no way he could travel there himself, but internationals could cross freely back and forth across the Green Line. So one day, we went to an abandoned farm on the side of the highway, following his precise directions. We retrieved a bucket of earth from the family home his parents had fled 50 years before. Nasser grew flowers and sprouted an olive tree in that soil. I hope Nasser and his family continue to grow, and I hope one day they can return with olives and flowers in hand. Well, would you like to civilly disobey and take the streets for a little bit, just two blocks, and then we'll end up at camp?
Let me make a short announcement.
Okay.
It's probably obvious to everyone, maybe not, we have an event on Saturday. It's a kid-friendly, family-friendly thing at Island Park.
University Park?
University. Thank you, yeah. And then we have another event later that day on Saturday with Michelle Shehadeh, a Palestinian, that's going to be giving a talk at the Unitarian Church at 5:30. Thanks.
This is from Common Dreams by Julia Conley from April 30th, 2024. With just over a week until the deadline for the Biden administration to certify that Israel's use of U.S.-supplied weapons is adhering to domestic and international law, Amnesty International USA submitted a report to the federal government detailing how American bombs and other weapons have been used in Israeli attacks that could constitute war crimes. The White House said the human rights group must inform Congress that Israel is violating humanitarian laws by May 8th as part of the National Security Memorandum on Safeguards and Accountability with Respect to Transferred Defense Articles and Defense Services, or NSM-20 process, and must immediately suspend the transfer of arms to the Israeli government. Amnesty's report focuses on several attacks on civilian infrastructure in which Israel used bombs and other weapons made by U.S. companies, including Boeing, as well as practices used by the Israeli government and Israel Defense Forces, or IDF, since they began bombarding Gaza in October in retaliation for a Hamas-led attack. Four of the IDF attacks took place in Rafah, where Israel is reportedly preparing a ground offensive after forcibly displacing more than 1 million Palestinians to the southern city and carrying out airstrikes for months. The four strikes in December and January killed at least 95 civilians, including 42 children, despite the U.S. and Israel's repeated claims that the IDF is targeting Hamas fighters. In all four attacks, reported Amnesty, there was no indication that the residential buildings hit could be considered legitimate military objectives or that people in the buildings were military targets, raising concerns that these strikes were direct attacks on civilians and civilian objects and must therefore be investigated as war crimes. The strikes, which included one on a five-story building inhabited by the Nofal family, were carried out with GBU-39 small-diameter bombs made in the U.S. by Boeing. The evidence is clear and overwhelming. The government of Israel is using U.S.-made weapons in violation of international humanitarian and human rights law and in a manner that is inconsistent with U.S. law and policy, said Amanda Klazing, National Director for Government Relations with Amnesty International USA. In order to follow U.S. laws and policies, the United States must immediately suspend any further arms to the government of Israel. Boeing was also the manufacturer of Joint Direct Attack Munitions, or JDAMs, that were used in October 2023 in two deadly unlawful airstrikes on homes full of Palestinian civilians, according to satellite imagery examined by Amnesty's weapons experts and remote sensing analysts. Those attacks killed 43 civilians, nearly half of whom were children. Other patterns in Israel's assault on Gaza, including its use of a 24-hour mass evacuation notice early on in its current escalation, ordering more than 1.1 million people in Gaza City and northern Gaza to go to the southern part of the enclave, its use of indiscriminate attacks with both U.S. and Israel-made weapons, its use of arbitrary administrative detention, and its denial of humanitarian assistance all show that the Biden administration's continued material support for the IDF violates U.S. and international law, Amnesty said. As progressives in the U.S. Congress have warned, Section 6201 of the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961, called 22 U.S.C. 2378-1, bars the federal government from providing military aid to any country that is blocking U.S. humanitarian aid. Israel Defense Minister Yoav Gallant's announcement on October 9, 2023, of a complete siege on Gaza with no electricity, no food, no water, no gas allowed in has deprived the enclave of equipment needed to provide health care to tens of thousands of people wounded in Israel's attacks, as well as pregnant women and newborns, the elderly, and people facing chronic illness. It has also placed Gaza's 2.3 million Palestinians at risk of a government-engineered famine, said Amnesty, with dozens of people, including children, already having starved to death. It's shocking that the Biden administration continues to hold that the government of Israel is not violating international humanitarian law with U.S.-provided weapons when our research shows otherwise and international law experts disagree, said Klazing. The International Court of Justice found the risk of genocide in Gaza is plausible and ordered provisional measures. President Joe Biden must end U.S. complicity with the government of Israel's grave violations of international law and immediately suspend the transfer of weapons to the government of Israel. The report comes days after Biden signed a military aid package, including $17 billion more for the IDF, after approving multiple weapons transfers to Israel since October. Ahead of the May 8th NSM 20 deadline, a coalition of more than 90 lawyers, including at least 20 who work in the Biden administration, is preparing to send a letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland warning that Israel's practices in Gaza likely violate the Arms Export Control Act, the Leahy Laws, and the Geneva Conventions, which prohibit disproportionate attacks on civilians. While spokespeople for the Biden administration have repeatedly said publicly that the White House does not accept allegations that Israel has violated international humanitarian law and made the U.S. complicit, the letter is just the latest sign of widening dissent within the government regarding Gaza. Senior U.S. officials recently told Secretary of State Antony Blinken in an international memo that Israel lacks credibility as it continues to claim it is adhering to international law. This is a moment where the U.S. government is violating its own laws and policy, a Department of Justice staffer who signed the new letter told Politico. The administration may be seeing silence or only a handful of resignations, but they are really not aware of the magnitude of discontent and dissent among the rank and file. Other patterns in Israel's assault on Gaza, including its use of a 24-hour mass evacuation notice early on in its current escalation, ordering more than 1.1 million people in Gaza City and northern Gaza to go to the southern part of the enclave, its use of indiscriminate attacks with both U.S. and Israel-made weapons, its use of arbitrary administrative detention, and its denial of humanitarian assistance all show that the Biden administration's continued material support for the IDF violates U.S. and international law, Amnesty said.
And, of course, the place of the family and all that. That one of the major mechanisms of counter-revolution in actually existing historical revolutionary processes is when the family is sort of reintroduced as the primary unit of social reproduction. That, you know, there was a moment in, I mean, that what happened in the Russian Revolution, there's a lot we can say about why it failed or where it ended up, but there was a moment that huge tens of thousands of Russian women were forming canteens and creches as a strategy of survival and saw the new societies coming out of that. And the, you know, the leadership of the Bolshevik Party initially was okay with that, and Kollontai backed it as a means of bringing women into the revolution, of mobilizing women's working capacities. And when the Civil War was over, they were like, yeah, no, we don't actually think that's a great idea. I mean, sure, there could be a couple more canteens than usual. Sure, neighbors can know each other a little bit more than they do in the capitalist world. But actually, families are the way to go. And they reimposed the family as a core, basic element of Russian society. And they did it in the interests of social order and natalism, in the interest of promoting birth. And there's a whole history around that. And so the one of the forms the counter-revolution takes is the private household. might not be able to get the mic to
I got one that goes with what you're saying. So what occurs to me is during disasters, like Hurricane Sandy and Katrina, the family did no good at all.
Right.
So, and then just to touch on what you're saying, though, that the mutual aid societies are what save those situations. There's stories of people going around saving them. And then just one quick thing, though. The Star Trek, there's a Star Trek episode maybe you're familiar with where the planet is going to be destroyed, so all the women, they're going to do polygamy to repopulate the world. So, and you know, in the Dr. Strangelove too, I'm going to wrap this up, Dr. Strangelove too, all the women are in the bunker, in the nuclear survival bunkers, they're going to be made to make babies. So I don't know where I'm going with that, but I mean, it could work both ways. A disaster could work both ways, I guess is what I'm saying. But I think we need a disaster.
I'll just briefly mention, the women that are speculated never actually appear in the film.
So yes, I think you can certainly look at disasters and catastrophes, and people do very much make plans, or prepper plans that are based on their nuclear families, often that involve guns and stored food. And those people are horrific to have as neighbors. It's just a disaster, right? In more ways than one. And there's no question that many, many people churn the collective strategies of mutual aid in catastrophes, as they do in rebellions, and that it becomes an encounter, right? And I talk about this with COVID, right? Tens of thousands of people in New York City went and talked to every one of their neighbors during COVID, right? And it was incredible. It was really quite a moment of sort of glimpsing something beyond the nuclear family as the primary unit of survival in this environment, in this context where we're all encouraged to like shelter in, you know, with our pod, with our nuclear families in isolation. Was a chance for lots and lots of people to go next door and to be like, do you need help getting groceries? And very importantly, it was a breakdown in capitalist commodity chains, that the counterpart to the nuclear family is the grocery store and the box store. And they are built in together, they rely on each other. And in New York City, where 20,000 people died over the course of a couple of months from COVID, the grocery stores were empty in many, many working class neighborhoods, and people had very limited options around getting food. And so suddenly these networks of neighbors transporting groceries for people, connecting to farmers and CSAs, like became connecting to soup kitchens, became a huge part of survival for many, many people. And it was very short-lived, as it often is, as sort of commodity chains get reintroduced. But I think that's a very good example of sort of how the family relies, the nuclear household, the private household relies on this whole architecture of capitalist society in order to function. And if we're going, if any of those pieces break down, the family doesn't really work in the way that we pretend it does, that it requires a very different set of relationships. One of the things I say very briefly in this book that actually, I think I should write an essay for Blindfield, the journal that Madeline edits someday, is that one of them is that if the commodity stores break down, if the box stores, grocery stores break down, or we have generalized social crisis that gets worse and worse, the nuclear family cannot function in that environment, but a cult can. And the cult or the commune are the two choices, right? And what is different about them, right? I mean, it's not straightforward, right? Some cults are nice, some communes are mean, right? So like what, and for me, the biggest difference is the cult is what it takes to reproduce it as a unit in a sustained way. And the commune is about opening on to broader processes of transformation. And this connects to how I think about communist revolution, that like, where I would locate the nightmare of counter-revolutions is what it takes to make the revolution survive in the capitalist world. That like actually, if a socialist workers' revolution happens in a place, it will be a failure if it doesn't become global. And one form of that failure is what became the Soviet Union. There are other forms of that failure, perhaps much worse ones, right? And so one thing that I think about is our future will not be one of nuclear families. It will not. Like, the level of ecological crisis will make that impossible for the vast majority of humanity. It will either be one of refugee camps and religious cults and authoritarian collective living facilities of various sorts and homeless shelters and, you know, institutional practices of collective living that are authoritarian and that are disturbing and are bad, or it will be one of the commune. And whatever that means, you know, as a transformative space of love and collective care that expands outwards, right? That has to expand outwards in order to be able to survive, in order to be able to be something other than the cold. And so one of the ways of sort of parsing science fiction stories is in watching the sort of unfolding of the commune or of the cold, often in tension in various recent accounts like Station 11 or various other recent shows that I think depict this in a very rich way. And that you close off the access to the outside, you seal off the borders, and what you have is a cult, whatever it is you want to call it.
Hi, thank you so much, both of you, for this extraordinary talk. I was wondering if you would like, or if you would be able to speak a little bit more of how you see the relation, maybe of family abolition to gender abolition, just because of the crux of gender and heterosexuality in that, in relation to property as well. So if you maybe could elaborate a little bit more on that.
Well, that's a theoretical project that I have not undertaken. I do not have an answer for that. I don't engage that in this book. In the novel, transforming the radical transformation in the gender division of labor leads to an intense diversification and proliferation around gender. That in post-revolutionary society, 40-some% of people are trans, and within that are a sort of radical experimentations and transformations around gender. And I am, thinking about the rise of trans children, as you know, trans children have been around for hundreds of years, and there's been medical support for trans children for decades now. But there are a lot more trans children in the world right now, coming out and arguing with their parents. And I think that's something that gives me a great deal of hope, and I think about it a lot, and how remarkable it is on many levels. And I very much think, and I, would attribute it, among other things, to a kind of loosening of gender roles that's happened over the last few decades. But I very, very much think that a revolutionary process that transforms how labor is organized would inevitably lead to a much richer, much more complex human relationship to gender than we have right now. And then I think, it's funny, I spent a lot of time talking about abolition as this, in the Hegelian sense, as the simultaneous destruction and preservation and unleashing and transformation of something, Aufheben, and it all its rich meanings. And I've struggled with it around gender in the ways that people struggle around family abolition. And I think it might have something to do with a kind of psychoanalytic resonance and a kind of resonance like one of the basic social facts that fascinates me and that I take a lot of solace in and I think about a lot is how poorly conversion therapy works, which is so interesting, right? Gender is clearly socially constructed, it's historically variable, it unfolds over time, and yet you take a trans child and put them through conversion therapy, they come out the other side unhappy every time. And they stay unhappy for a really long time until they have a chance to do something different with their gender. And how strange that is, how remarkable that is, that there is a level of unconscious identification around gender that goes very deep in the constituting ourselves as subjects that can take many, many different forms in the world. But that if we don't have a chance to take seriously, the consequences are really quite negative. And I think that's compatible with a gender abolitionist framework, but that sometimes that the sort of strange immutability of gender identification in the failure of conversion therapy is something that I think about a lot.
Yeah, I would just say something I really appreciate on this note, though I'm fascinated by what you just said, is you write about the family ideal, right? And the family ideal, not as a reality, but right, but as having this kind of disciplinary function over us that has to do with white supremacy, that has to do with gender normativity and sexual normativity, right? So I think that's a powerful, maybe it's the thing to think about next, right, is making that link more clear. But I see that as a very clear link in how you discuss specifically how the family is idealized under capitalism, right, and the violence of that ideal, how it hangs over our attempts to create different kinds of social relationships. So.
And I do contrast that family ideal to what I call gender liberation, and I'm a little unclear about what that is, but it probably has something to do with what people mean when they talk about gender abolition. So I propose one more question. We've been talking for an hour and 40 minutes, and I want to encourage everyone to buy lots of books, not just mine. And if you want your book signed, I'm happy to do that. I love the signed books I have. So let's go with one more question, please, in the back.
Hi. I'll start out by saying, for Star Trek fans, there is a free play in the park today at 5 and tomorrow at 5, and it's a redo of an episode of Next Generation.
Wow. Which park?
Oh, Amazon Park. Yes. So I just finished reading a book called Restoring the Kinship Worldview, and it is a collection of precepts from indigenous voices, and it seemed like a lot of the precepts and the discussions of them, a lot of it leads back to a concept that the editors called the evolved nest. And I'm wondering if you know about this concept, and if your book, how that concept might mesh with your third part in the utopian vision of it, and or if any ideas of indigenous family come into play in your book.
I'm not familiar with the concept of evolved nest, and you're welcome to share more about it if you'd like. There is a very rich literature of indigenous writing on both the history and politics of the family and on thinking expansively and dynamically about kin relations, including thinking about what it means to take seriously kin relations with non-human beings. And relating changing relationships to property and land to changing dynamics of kinship, right? That literature is certainly one that informs me. Lou Cornham has written quite movingly about indigenous communism, and we work together in Pinto. And in this book, I engage some of literature around becoming kin and making kin. And it definitely has something to do with how we think about communizing care. I also engage much more extensively with the history of settler colonialism in the family. And I'll say a few words about that. And this is all from indigenous scholarship and writing about settler colonialism, that there were sort of two, often colonies, initial colonists, were often men organized in military structures to varying extents. There was a huge part of conquest, including in North America. But in order to get the colonies to stabilize, they needed women. They prioritized trying to figure out how to get married couples to move to the frontier. And this was a huge concern. And they recognized nuclear families, white nuclear families,
as the absolute foundation of being able to build nations. You could not have a settler nation with just men, right? And so there's a whole history around the settler family and the centrality of heterosexuality and private property in that. And then meanwhile, a whole history around indigenous genocide. So of course, indigenous people around the world have had many, many different ways of organizing relationships, kinships, intimacy, including many examples of queer relationships, collective property, sort of not family, not a property, not arising, sitting exclusively with an individual or a family was extremely common in America. So very different ideas of property and very different ideas of what constitutes a primary relationship, and various kinds of collective housing, collective living, collective kin relations were very, very common. And of course, the settlers, the colonists, were just horrified by this. The Catholic Church and missionaries and settler states, that indigenous kin relations was a major effort around destroying it. And there were two very different, I mean, they happened concurrently, but I really focus on Canada and North America. Then meanwhile, you know, there were these huge campaigns around exterminating people, killing everyone, forcing them off their land. But then there were two strategies that really focused on the question of kin and family. One strategy was separating children from their parents. So that, which, you know, there's a parallel in what happened during slavery and Native alienation. And children were put into what were called residential schools or Indian boarding schools or other things, initially run by the Catholic Church, and later they got some state support. And they were really instruments of mass torture and mass death. And, you know, there's been all these news stories just over the last couple of years about digging up these mass graves at these schools. And their efforts were really trying to make children white, right? They banned speaking any language but English. They sometimes assigned children out to white families, like adopted them out, and really figuring out how to attack and destroy the kin relations amongst indigenous people. And this has always been a part history of the family, right? This has always been central to what the family is, that certain families count and other care relations need to be destroyed. But then almost simultaneously, there was another strategy, which was allotments. So they seized indigenous land and they redistributed it to indigenous people based on family ownership, based on individual male-headed nuclear family structures. And this was an effort at destroying the collective property, collective governance, and collective life of indigenous nations. And allotments were developed in the United States, but also taken up in Canada under other names. And so here, the nuclear family was the instrument of genocide. It was the strategy of genocide. They also, in the process, took a lot of land and sold it to white people and other things. But the idea being an individual indigenous family is just another family, right? They could be foreclosed upon, they could borrow money, they could sell to white people, they could do all sorts of things with their property. And what's destroyed is what is beyond the family, the care relations, the collective property relations that characterize indigenous life. So this is, I think this is extremely illustrative of the history of the family, right? You have on the one hand settler families that count, and then on the other hand, you have the simultaneous processes of trying to separate parents and children, or alternatively, force them into living in a nuclear family arrangement based on private property. And so that for me is really, was like piecing that together in the literature was really quite powerful, quite helpful to me. Okay, so let's end there. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you. We're going to take a break for 20 minutes.
Thank you.